Okay, so I'm going to talk about the third acceptance verse, which is for the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. And how do you talk about enlightenment? You know, it's just so vast. It's so sort of far away. And you know, a long time ago, I think I came to the conclusion that it only makes sense if you think of lifetimes of practice. You know, it's such a vast goal. It's much, much more than one could accomplish in one lifetime or even a few lifetimes. It's huge. So it's in a sense it feels very, very distant. At the same time, we're connected to it. You know, we're already connected to it because we're connected to enlightenment through the Buddha, because it's the Buddha who gained enlightenment, and we're connected to it through our faith in the Buddha and through doing the practices that the Buddha taught us. So, in a sense, the Buddha is reaching down to us with his adhisthana, with his blessings, and we're reaching up to the Buddha through the practices that we do, through the puja, through the faith and devotion that we cultivate, and so on. So, it's a long way away, but we're connected to it. And taking it as an acceptance verse, that is the goal of the Buddhist life. It's not optional. that is what we're practicing for. We're not practicing just to make the world a cozier place or to have a better worldly life. When we ask for ordination, when we get ordained, we're doing it for the attainment of enlightenment, not just for self-development, for improving our life in the world, for as Dharmadeepa would put it, creating a sort of Buddhist version of samsara. So I think the first thing you notice with this verse, with this third verse, is that it takes place in relationship to the other three verses. And the other three verses are with loyalty to my teachers, in harmony with friends and brethren, and for the benefit of all beings. So what I draw from that is that enlightenment or our search for enlightenment is relational. It takes place within other relationships. There's no such thing as a personal enlightenment. There's no such thing as me personally gaining enlightenment. Only me and other people can do it. I need other people to gain enlightenment. And so it takes place within the context of reverence and gratitude for our teachers, of metta and mudita for our brothers and sisters in the order, and compassion in the sense of delight in the spiritual potential of all living beings. So there's this very, very strong context of positive emotion which we need to approach enlightenment. We need other people. The spiritual life is not a solitary activity. Even the hermit, even Milarepa, or the hermit, is in relationship with others. And in this context, I remember years ago when Prakasha, you know, who's a very great meditator, actually. He's one of, I think he's probably the closest we've got to a hermit in some ways, you know, to a yogi, and I have a great deal of respect for him. And when he lived at Gukhyaloka, at the Gukhyaloka Vihara, and he was there for about 5 years, and he was doing these very, very long solitary retreats, but he was reporting into Shabda every month, and something of his experience living at Gukhyaloka, not everyone could live at Gukhyaloka, something of his experience was coming into the whole order through his monthly reports into Shabda. And so he was in relationship with other people. And I don't really believe that you can practice in solitude without feeling in relationship with brothers and sisters in the Dharma. I just don't see how your practice could hold up if that's what you were doing. You'd need to feel in relationship. And I know myself from solitary retreats that very often on solitary retreats, I'm vividly aware of the Padmaloka community. You know, it's, in a way, I'm almost more vividly aware of them. It's as if they're all around me and I can contact them through my Metta Bhavana, through my Brahma Viharas. So it's relational. We're always in relationship with other people. We need other people. And enlightenment itself is relational. The Buddha's enlightenment was relational. His enlightenment was not complete until he communicated the truth that he discovered successfully, till he communicated it to the five disciples. And that's what we celebrate when we celebrate Dharma Day, Dharma Chakra Pravartana Day, the turning of the wheel of the Dharma. And then, of course, there's this really mysterious concept, which is the Sambhogakaya, which is one of the bodies of the Buddha. It's the archetypal body of the Buddhas. And what's particular about the Sambhogakaya is it's relational. So it's the body, the archetypal body, within which the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas communicate with each other. Those great beings on the same level, there's a mutual communication through them. They take delight in each other. That's the Sambhogakaya. So I think it's really a good question to ask, you know, right at the beginning, why do I practice the Dharma? And yes, certainly, you know, our motive for practicing Dharma will change as we progress on the path. But am I practicing the Dharma for enlightenment? Or is it for some other reason? You know, is it to join a group? Is it for prestige? Is it for reasons of self-development? Or have I got an idea of an individual enlightenment that I can gain insight for myself, but some sort of model that doesn't involve other people? So maybe that's a good thing to explore in the groups. Maybe that's the first thing to explore in the groups. So, as I said, enlightenment seems impossibly far away, and the work of lifetimes, but at the same time, all our practices conduce to it, and it's the goal of our spiritual life. And some help as to understanding what that could actually mean in my practice and how to relate to enlightenment came from a seminar that Bhante did on the survey of Buddhism. And one of the questions that he answered was, how do you explain Nirvana to beginners? Or how do you explain enlightenment to beginners? And his answer was quite interesting. He said, well, first of all, you have to get away from the idea of Nirvana being a place or a location that you're moving towards. And then you try to communicate something about the difference between skillful states of mind and unskillful states of mind, about the reactive mind and the creative mind. And you try to communicate a feeling for this creative process, of the spiral path, which we're all treading. And then you just suggest that this could go on indefinitely. You could go on becoming more and more intensely positive, more and more creative. And as you continued, the whole spiritual life would become a movement in that direction. And Nirvana, or enlightenment, is the furthest conceivable point in that process. But the process goes on beyond that. It goes on, as it were, beyond the horizon. And Bhante goes on to say that there's an advantage in thinking about enlightenment or Nirvana in this way. And the advantage is that we can say something from our own experience. So as Buddhists, we have an experience already of greater positivity and greater creativity than we had before. And there's a whole stream within us. If you're sensitive enough to it, if you practice intensely enough, there's a whole stream within us moving in that direction. And you can tune into that stream sometimes, this momentum of greater creativity, greater positivity, moving in the direction of enlightenment. And I think it's very important to sensitise ourselves to that in us, and to really get a sense of that, and to be able to come back to it, and to relate to it. And if you keep on practicing, you realise, well, you can keep on doing this indefinitely. You can keep on with this process indefinitely. You can keep on just practicing the spiritual life and gaining more and more positivity, more and more creativity. And as you move on, your experience of yourself starts to change. And it goes beyond what you formerly recognised as yourself. You begin to enter new ways of being. A new sort of consciousness starts to open up, which goes beyond your present experience. And you can just imagine that continually going on forever, until at a certain point you reach a culmination of that creativity and positivity, and that's something like nirvana or enlightenment. So I found this a very, very useful way of feeling that I had a connection with enlightenment, to feel part of this stream which we're connected to, moving in the direction of enlightenment. And that process can just go on and on and on continuously. There's no end to it. So that's what we're engaged in.
Two friends of mine. One friend of mine,
he'd had quite a difficult life. And he'd had quite a lot of suffering. And he came across the Dharma. And he was very concerned that enlightenment was a possibility, because he felt he just did not want to go back to that suffering. So he wanted something that was going to be the end of suffering. That's what he was looking for. And he talked to another friend of mine who's quite a senior order member. And he said, are you confident that you can gain enlightenment? And my friend's answer was quite interesting. He said, me as I am now, I can't gain enlightenment. There's no question of gaining enlightenment as I am now. And I thought that's quite interesting, because I think when we think about enlightenment, we think of ourselves as gaining enlightenment as we are now. And we think, no, how can I, as I am now, gain enlightenment? But it's just completely beyond us. But what we're actually talking about here is growth, you know, that we're going to grow. And we're talking about spiral conditionality, which is gradual, broad, and cumulative. And me as I am now, I can't gain enlightenment, but I can see I've changed to a certain extent, and I can go on changing. And I can imagine that at some point, I'm going to grow into something that's unimaginable from my present mode of experience and my present mode of consciousness. And my experience bears this out, because I've changed a certain amount. I'm very different to when I started practicing the Dharma, and I can just imagine that process going on and on. And what's more, I have people around me who I can see that process happening in, and that gives me confidence that that's possible. So it's a cumulative process, it's gradual and it's broad. And in the Udana, the Buddha compares the spiritual life to the mighty ocean. And he says that just as the mighty ocean slopes down gradually, tends down gradually, so in the Dharma, the training is gradual. There's no abrupt penetration of knowledge. So it's a gradual path, it's a cumulative path, it's a broad path. And what we need to do is systematically, broadly, gradually, bring the whole of our life into line with enlightenment. And that's a huge task, and it really helps if you can consider the possibility of future lives. And then, in a way, it takes the stress out of it. It takes some of the pressure out of it. All we need to do is just take the next step from where we are and just keep taking the next step. So one way of looking at the five spirit, one way of looking at this is through the five spiritual faculties. One way of bringing our whole life into line with the Dharma is through the five spiritual faculties. And the five spiritual faculties are faith and wisdom, energy and meditation, and mindfulness, which is the balancing faculty. And they all need to be present in our practice. And the word for spiritual faculty is indriya. And indriya means faculty, but it also means sense, as in the five senses. So just in the same way that with the five senses we navigate the physical world, through the five spiritual faculties we orientate ourselves in the spiritual world. So the first of these is Shraddha. And as you know, Shraddha is the response of our whole being to enlightenment. It's primarily Shraddha in the Buddha, in the Buddha gained enlightenment. It means to place the heart upon its wholeheartedness. And Shraddha is said to arise in dependence upon dukkha. But Shraddha arises upon a particular type of dukkha. It's this existential dukkha. So you don't necessarily have to be having a miserable life to develop Shraddha. It might be that your life seems to be going really well, and you've got a happy relationship, maybe you've got a happy family life, you've got a creative job, but somewhere there's something of you that's just saying there must be more. This can't be it. There must be more to life than this. And it's that little voice that, if we listen to it, that can start to get us involved in the spiritual life. And I think that's probably where most of us start. So the path rests on Shraddha. And Shraddha has vision. It's the emotional equivalent of wisdom. And with Shraddha, we intuit the truths behind the formulations of the Dharma. It's what's highest in us reverberating with what's highest in the universe. And it's the quality that connects us with the goal. It's through Shraddha that we're connected with enlightenment. And it doesn't really matter where we are on the path. What matters is that we're connected with enlightenment through Shraddha. And Shraddha deepens into conviction. And it's a sort of direct knowing that the Dharma is true. And then it's truly the counterpart to wisdom. And yes, Yeshe Sogyal says, never be parted from the conditions for faith to arise. It's very easy to confuse pleasure with Shraddha. We need joy in the spiritual life. We need to enjoy our spiritual lives. But we can't rely on joy. We can't rely on enthusiasm always being there. We need something deeper than that. Our practice is not always going to be comfortable. We're quite messy. We have messy samskaras. Human nature is vast and complex. As we go deeper, we don't know what's going to emerge. We don't know what's going to come up. When we embark on the spiritual life, we sign a blank check. But we have to keep going. There's an American teacher called Reginald Ray, who you've probably heard of. And he was in an interview, and he was asked whether practicing the Dharma had made him happier. And he said, from a certain point of view, practicing the Dharma had completely ruined his life. And I think what he meant was that it's not going to make your life comfortable. Bhante puts it more positively, I think, in the Sutra of Golden Light lectures, when he says that when we practice the Dharma, we take in the golden light. And we've taken in a lot of other things as well. And at a certain point, there's going to be a battle between the golden light and, if you like, the reactive mind. And they're going to try to throw each other out. But hopefully it's very difficult to throw out the golden light once it's already in there. Suvajra once told me that towards the end of Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche's life, one of Bhante's teachers, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, Suvajra went to see him in India. And at that time, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche was old and sick. And he was teaching in a hall. When Suvajra came in, Dilgo Khyentse was giving empowerments or giving initiation, and there were hundreds of people there taking initiation from Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. And at a certain point in the proceedings, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche's attendant came up to him and he gave him some medicine. And when he gave him the medicine, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche made a bitter face. And afterwards, Suvajra was talking to Bhante about this. And Bhante's comment was, the Tibetans see everything symbolically. And that even for a very high lama, sometimes the Dharma can be a very bitter medicine. So at such times, and we're all going to meet them, at such times, faith and commitment and spiritual friends are all that are going to see us through. We may find we don't even want to practice when it all falls apart, when we're in doubt and confusion. We need something deeper than pleasure, deeper than inspiration, deeper than enthusiasm. And that's when we need Shraddha. And you could say that inspiration is a little bit like a very beautiful mountain stream that's just rolling down from the mountains. It's sparkling in the sunlight. It's very beautiful to watch. It's very exciting. That's what inspiration is like. But Shraddha is more like a very, very deep river, a great body of water, quite stately, moving down towards the sea with a great amount of weight and all the tributaries feeding into it. And it just keeps going. There's this enormous body of water just moving slowly down towards the sea. Shraddha's more like that. And it's slow, it's not necessarily exciting, and it just builds and builds and builds over time, but it's reliable, it's what you can place the heart upon. And I think these days we have a great sophistication in our thinking. We're very good at manipulating concepts, but certainly in the West we probably have very little Shraddha, and we really need to awaken the faculty of Shraddha and the faculty of imagination. Okay, next, wisdom or pranya. So we need to get clear about the teachings, and we need to get clear especially about Sangharakshita's teachings, because that's the particular path that we're following. We need to understand the teachings, and we need to get to know the path and where we want to go. And every evening we're circumambulating the stupa, and on the stupa are the three axioms of the message of Dado Rinpoche: cherish the Dharma, live united, radiate love. And in order to cherish the Dharma, you have to know what it is. you have to actually study. You have to take part in discussion groups, talking the Dharma, Dharma Katha. In a way, in the discussion group, it doesn't matter who has the wise word. you're mutually trying to dig deeper into the truth and to uncover the truth of the Dharma. Bhante said to me once that it would be good if every Ord member had just one text that they could lead study on and that they knew really well. So if you don't think you're great at study, maybe you just take one text that you really like, that really speaks to you, and learn it well. And in Pieces of Fire, there's a passage where he talks about how to study, or how to study the Dharma, what sort of approach you need when you study the Dharma. And what he says is this. He says, many years ago, I constantly asked myself, how does this teaching relate to one's actual spiritual experience, to the spiritual life and to spiritual development? Why did the Buddha say this? Why was the Buddha concerned with this? Where does it connect up with spiritual life? So I think that's what we've got to look at when we're studying the Dharma. We've got to actually look and say, well, why is the Buddha teaching this? What's its relevance to our actual spiritual life? So we need to reflect on what we've studied. We need to apply it to our lives. And we need to meditate on it. And the third of the spiritual faculties is meditation. And I just want to make a few brief points about meditation and say a little bit more about sadhana. So I think the first thing I want to say is we've got this amazing system of meditation, system of practice, with integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, and just sitting. And it's remarkable, because if you practice those five stages together, what you find is that all the stages feed into each other and permeate each other, so that each one of the practices partakes of all the qualities of the whole system. So I think if you're ever on solitary retreat, it's a very good thing to practice all those five stages in one day and get a sense of how they permeate each other, so that everything becomes, every meditation becomes both samatha and vipassana. I think we need to develop stronger samatha. I've noticed that we have quite busy lives, and we need to develop samatha meditation. We need to develop calming meditation, practices like mindfulness and positive emotion, which are actually going to give us a grounding upon which we can actually develop insight. You need quite a still mind to develop insight, and I think we probably need to create the conditions in our lives which are going to bring more samatha, not just to our meditation practice, but to our lives. I think that's a priority in a way, if we're serious about making progress towards enlightenment. And that probably means simplifying our lives, and particularly maybe spending less time on the computer and on electronic gadgets. I also think we need to go much deeper into the insight practices that we already have. Practices like the six-element practice. The reason Bhante's chosen the six-element practice as our main insight practice is because it's so concrete. You know, it's actually, you actually experience your relationship with the elements in your body and in the world outside. So many of these insight practices, they're so heady, they're so abstract, but this is quite a concrete practice, and it connects you with yourself and it connects you with the world around you. And then I think also we need to go deeper into the reflection on conditionality, you know, the Nidana chain practice. And we did this earlier in the year with a retreat we did called This Being That Becomes. And it was really clear, doing that practice day after day, just how immediate the path becomes to you, because you're reflecting on those positive nidanas, you're reflecting on the path, and you get a real feeling for what the path involves by reflecting on it in meditation. So I think that's quite important. But I'll leave you to talk about all these areas in the groups. What I wanted to say a little bit more about is sadhana. And at the time of ordination, we take up a visualization practice, or perhaps more accurately, a familiarization practice on a Buddha or a Bodhisattva. And this is enlightenment as a transcendental person. And we respond to persons more strongly than to abstract ideas or to concepts. As Bhante says in the Three Jewels, in the section on the goal, personhood is our highest category. It's you at the end of the path. The Buddha or the Bodhisattva that you meditate on is you at the end of the path. It's what you can become. And we can build up a relationship with our Yidam, with the Buddha or Bodhisattva that we take up at the time of ordination, in the same way that we can build up a relationship with another person. So you sit down every morning, you meditate on the Buddha or the Bodhisattva, you meet the Buddha or the Bodhisattva, and I see it, well, it's the highlight of my day, and I see it as a sort of transcendental Kalyanamitrita, you know, and it's also your most immediate link with the Dharma, because it's that aspect of enlightenment with which you have a direct affinity. A bit like Shraddha, it's that aspect of the Dharma that you resonate with, that you have an affinity with. So it's your gateway into the riches of enlightenment. And my practice is Vajrasattva. I meditate on Vajrasattva every morning. And over the years, I feel I've come closer to Vajrasattva. He's become a stronger presence. Certainly, when you do the practice, sometimes he seems very close, he's very immediate. Other times he feels very, very distant. And sometimes it's easy to become dispirited when that happens. But what the Tibetans say is that you need to actually really feel that the Buddha or the Bodhisattva that you meditate on is present all the time. He's present above your head all the time. And in a way, it's not Vajrasattva who comes and goes. It's my own mind that comes and goes. Vajrasattva is there all the time. And there's so much beauty in these figures. There's so much colour and there's so much significance. All the ornaments, the mudras, every aspect reflects reality. Every aspect is significant and meaningful. And in a lot of the practice, you just sit in the presence of the Buddha or the Bodhisattva. You're receptive, you feel their presence, you feel their qualities, you recite the mantra and verses, and this drama starts to unfold. And at the end of the practice, you dissolve the figure back into shunyata. And that figure's been very vivid for you for the time that you've been visualizing it, during the time you've been worshipping the Buddha or the Bodhisattva. It's been a very vivid experience. And then at the end of the practice, it just dissolves back into the clear blue sky. And you reflect that all life is like this. We have all these experiences, they seem very intense, and then they're gone, you know, and we look back and we think, what was that all about? You know, why was there so much drama about that? What was it all about? And then we move on to something else. And this is the dreamlike nature of experience. All those things, they seem so significant, but they're so insubstantial. They come and they go and they move on. The figure that we meditate on is also a protector. He's a mind protector. He protects our minds. He protects our mental states. And he's always pleased to see you. The Buddha or the Bodhisattva's love is completely unconditional. I also tend to think that the Buddha or the Bodhisattva that you meditate on goes beyond death. And I think, well, what is it? You know, when you're on your deathbed, when you're dying, and you're trying to bring to mind the Dharma, what is it that's going to come to mind? I don't think it's going to be a concept. I don't think you're going to be thinking about the four shunyatas or something like that. But I think you're probably much more likely to relate to a figure or to a myth, you know, at the time of death. And the mind is much more enduring than the body. So that connection maybe will flow in, will flow beyond death, and that connection will go on beyond death. So just a word of caution about meditation. Experiences in meditation are a good sign, and they can also be troublesome. Don't over-identify with meditation experiences. Don't get too attached to them. People can get very upset when you don't value their meditation experiences as much as they do. And we're going to have insight experiences. You know, of course we're going to have insight experiences. We're Buddhists, you know, we're trying to gain enlightenment. But use whatever happens to help others. Don't get attached to it. Don't turn it into a personal possession. Otherwise it just becomes another form of ego clinging. Use the vision to transform yourself in the light of that vision. Transform the rest of your life. Bring the rest of your life into line with that. And use it to help others. A friend of mine, Kalyanamati, sometimes he goes to see Banti and he has very good conversations with Banti. And he went to see him and he said that he'd been doing a lot of the sixth element practice and he was wondering if he was a stream entrant. And Banti said, well, if there's any question about whether you're a stream entrant or not, you're not a stream entrant. And so Kalyanamati was... they carried on talking and Kalyanamati was very, very concerned about whether he was whether he had insight or not. And Banti said, don't be over concerned with insight. Just get on with your practice and let insight take care of itself. Otherwise, he said, you're like a child who keeps measuring himself and asking, am I growing? And he said, you don't need to keep measuring yourself, you just need to keep drinking your milk. So just keep up your daily meditation practice. Get on retreat as often as possible. And if you make the effort, the fruits will come. You don't need to worry about them. Okay, more briefly, I want to move on to virya. And virya is energy, vigour, striving. The word virya is connected with hero. So in a way, it's the heroic virtues. Also, the English word virtue is connected with virya. And incidentally, virtue used to mean strength. That's the original meaning of virtue, which is quite interesting. That it's your virtues, it's your ethical integrity that gives you strength. It's a powerful inclination towards the skillful. And it's usually spoken of in terms of the four right efforts. The effort to develop and maintain skillful mental states and to eradicate and prevent unskillful mental states. So enlightenment is the complete eradication of greed, hatred and delusion. Virya, I think, is also expressed in the 10 precepts that we take at ordination, also called the 10 ordination vows. They're quite a weighty, solemn undertaking. And you could see the 10 precepts also as a path to enlightenment. Virya is also the altruistic aspect of our practice. So it balances meditation. Meditation is more inward going, and it needs to be balanced by these outward going, other regarding, heroic virtues. And the Mahayana talks about developing merit and wisdom. And merit, you could say, is all the qualities. Merit is punya. Jnana is wisdom. And merit is all the qualities that we need to develop in order to help others. So that's our virya. And we have this in the 10 positive precepts that we take. And we also have it in the so-called Bodhisattva precepts, the precepts of a Sangha, the precepts for benefiting others. And we do this through working together. We practice virya through working together for the benefit of others, for the benefit of the world. We have so much to give to the world, and the world so much needs it. And I think we need to forget about difficulties. We need to actually rejoice much more in what we've got and get out and help people. There are a lot of people who are suffering through not coming into contact with the Dharma, and that's where our energy should be going. It shouldn't be going into acrimonious disputes. It should be going into really appreciating and valuing and cherishing what we've got and taking it out into the world, because the world needs it, and that's virya. So we really need this quality of virya, and that balances our meditation, and our meditation feeds into our virya, and we meditate in order to make us more effective in helping others. We gain insight to make us more effective in helping others. And if you look at these Buddha figures, like particularly if you look at Amitabha there, you see that there are two auras, and the big blue aura around his body is the is punya. That's merit. That's the qualities that we develop for the benefit of others. And the much smaller aura around his head is jnana, the wisdom. And as you notice, the body aura is much bigger. So we develop both side by side. We develop side by side punya and jnana, the two accumulations, the two heaps. Okay, lastly, sati or mindfulness. And mindfulness is the balancing faculty. And its primary meaning is to recollect or to remember. And I think one of the great obstacles of the spiritual life is that we forget. We take up the Dharma and we forget. Maybe conditions change and we forget what we're doing. We forget why we practice the Dharma, or that we do it for others, or we forget the progress that we've already made, and maybe we stop coming on retreat, we stop meeting up with spiritual friends. We forget that in order to make progress, we have to create the right conditions. We need to set ourselves in the right conditions. And this is very, very important, that when we get ordained, it's only effective going for refuge. And it's only effective if we keep putting ourselves in the conditions which support that. So up until irreversibility, the conditions take the place of insight. After irreversibility, we naturally make progress. We're naturally drawn up into the Dharma. Before irreversibility, we need conditions around us which are going to keep reminding us of our practice, and we need our friends to keep reminding us to practice. So never underestimate the importance of conditions. Never think of moving away from the Sangha. Think very, very seriously if you're thinking of doing that. And maybe let your friends help you work out what conditions you need to stay in this stream moving towards enlightenment. So I just want to start to draw this to a close. And I just want to mention a retreat that I was on last year at Addis Dharma with Subhuti. Or Subhuti was doing a seminar. And he was doing a seminar on insight. In this seminar, he said, okay, just think. He just said, let's take the emphasis off experiences, you know, off meditation experiences, and just think, just bring to mind, discuss, go away in groups and discuss, what are the practices and conditions that have helped you to lessen self-clinging, ill will, and pride, and have increased your faith? So what are the conditions and practices that have helped you to weaken self-clinging, ill will and pride, and have increased your faith? And that's what insight is. You know, it's when you actually start to, you begin to develop insight when you start to become less self-centered, when you start to weaken self-clinging, when you start to weaken pride, when you start to weaken ill will. So maybe that's something to think about in the groups. You know, like think about your spiritual life and think about all those conditions which have helped you to weaken self-clinging, aversion, and pride, and which have increased your faith. And it's not just meditation, you know, it's not just Dhamma study, it's everything that we do, you know, because everything that we do, every practice that we do in Tri Ratna is for the attainment of enlightenment, it's conducive to enlightenment. And Tri Ratna works best, the path that Bhante's laid out works best if you can practice the path as fully as possible, if you can have as many of those aspects of spiritual growth in place. So maybe look at your life also and think, are there any aspects which are weak, which I need to strengthen in order to have this complete approach to enter this stream more completely that's flowing towards enlightenment? Some years ago, I think it was at Gukyaloka, Dharmarati asked Bhante, because, you know, Bhante is an old man, he's not going to live much longer, and Dharmarati was concerned, you know, about what happened after Bhante's death, and he asked Bhante, have we got everything we need? You know, have we got everything we need to gain enlightenment? And Bhante came back quite categorically and said, we've got more than we need, you know, we've got much more than we need to gain enlightenment. You just have to keep practicing, just taking one step, taking the next step. Follow the spiral path. You keep choosing faith rather than craving. Again and again and again, in every moment, in every decision, faith is not something we have and we just keep. We have to keep choosing faith. We have to keep going for refuge to enlightenment. We have to keep renouncing the world, renouncing worldly values, nissarana, not going for refuge to the world. And in the end, we've got all the conditions. It's down to us. And only we can do it. You know. And we have to decide whether we want to take that path, enter that stream, moving towards enlightenment. And I want to finish with a quote from Lama Govinda, from the foundations of Tibetan mysticism. And he's basically saying that. He's saying it's down to us. And it's down to the way that we view ourselves and the way that we view what we're capable of. So this is what he says. He says, just as an artist will hold before himself the greatest masters as worthy exemplars, irrespective of whether he'll be able to reach their perfection or not, thus, whosoever wants to progress spiritually must turn towards the highest ideal within the range of his understanding. This will urge him to ever higher achievements, for nobody can say from the beginning where the limits of one's capacities are. In fact, it is more probable that it is the intensity of our striving that determines these limits. He who strives for the highest will partake of the highest forces, and thereby he himself will move his limits into the infinite. He will realize the infinite in the finite, making the finite the vessel of infinity, the temporal, the virical, of the timeless.